from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Stephen Chu made history as the first Asian American and the first scientist and Nobel Prize winner to head the U.S. Department of Energy. He served during President Obama's first term, where he oversaw a $35 billion plus government investment in clean energy before returning to work as a physics professor at Stanford. He continues to speak out on the dangers of climate change, and he'll join us to talk about his time in Washington, his current work on sustainable energy, and the intersection between science and public policy. Next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum program. Former Secretary of Energy and Physics Nobel Laureate Stephen Chu joins us for this morning's second forum hour. Former head of Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, he's professor of physics at Stanford, and we welcome him to forum, and good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you.
I should mention that a few weeks ago, I was at a Public Policy Institute of California panel. Actually, I was moderating the panel set up by Mark Baldessari that included Secretary Chu and former Secretary of Labor and State George Shultz and Mary Nichols from the Air Resources Board. And I think, Stephen Chu, it's fair of me to say that that panel was pretty optimistic about energy solutions to climate change, about the way things have been developing here in California. But the Lawrence Berkeley Lab, where you used to hang out, put out a report last month that said all the programs in California that have been put into place really aren't enough, and all the state's electricity will have to be, well, from renewable sources by 2050. Let's go to that. I mean, is that even possible?
Well, I don't think it's possible to go all renewable sources, but the issue is really how much we can decrease the carbon emissions. So if you have some fossil, for example, natural gas plants that supply electricity if the sun stops shining for a week, you would need to begin to develop – you would have to actually deploy by then methods of capturing and sequestering that carbon. So it's really the carbon emission that's what it's concerned about, not just all renewable.
So if we're going to use coal or natural gas in the future, we're going to have to capture carbon emissions from both.
Yes, if it's a significant part, and by significant I mean 10-20-30% of the electricity generated or more, you're going to have to capture a large fraction of it.
Well, we've done really well, though, in many respects. I mean, I was looking at your letter that you put out when you left as head of energy, and the last 4 years, you said, have been essentially a production of clean and renewable energy from wind to solar doubling.
That's true, but you have to also realize the point we're starting from. It was at a very low fraction of the total amount of electricity that we're producing. We have, in the outset, it's about 6% hydro, maybe about 4% of wind and solar. That is going to be increasing rapidly in the future. But remember, we need to decrease our carbon emissions worldwide by something like 80% by the time we get to mid-century.
Well, I want to,
and this doesn't even touch the transportation sector,
right? And I want to talk with you about ways to combat climate change. But during your tenure as Secretary of Energy, a question that came up repeatedly, and I'd like to have you speak to it now, was when you were moving toward all this green car talk. Why electric as opposed to hydrogen?
Well, let's look at the first. Electric vehicles do make sense when you're in an urban or suburban environment where range over, let's say, 250, 300 miles is not that critical. The people who own electric vehicles like Teslas that can go about 260 miles don't seem to have much range anxiety at all. And that makes a very – even people with cars that have less than 100 miles, as long as it's restricted to city suburban driving, when talking to those owners, they seem pretty happy about that. if you want to go longer range, where you really it's important to have 300 or 400 miles and faster refueling, then you are led back to either liquid hydrocarbons, which can be much greener than they are now, or hydrogen. Hydrogen has some advantages. You can refuel much faster. It potentially has longer range, but it's a totally different infrastructure in terms of developing the fuel cells at low cost, developing the hydrogen distribution system, things of that nature. But I would say, technically, you want to pursue fuel cells, you want to pursue electric vehicles, and you don't make an early decision that one is going to be better than the other. Now, I personally think that the technology is further along in electric vehicles. That's why major manufacturers are putting them in cars they sell today. When, you know, we'll wait and see whether hydrogen fuel cell vehicles will catch on. One of the things I do want to add, though, is I haven't seen it discussed much at all, but it seems to me that if I were an engineer designing a hydrogen fuel cell vehicle, I would use a philosophy the way the Chevy Volt's philosophy is. You get that fuel cell to work in its sweet spot. It charges the battery. The acceleration, all the other things you demand of a car are delivered by the battery motor system. So in this way, it may be possible to make a durable fuel cell less expensive because it's only operating in the sweet spot. It's not being asked to power ramp up and down, just as an Atkinson engine in a Chevy Volt is working in its sweet spot where it's the most efficient. And I think that that would be probably a better way to design a hydrogen fuel cell car than to ask the fuel cell to directly apply the electricity that feeds the electric motors. You know, have a plug-in vehicle-sized battery that the instant torque can be supplied by the electric motor and the hydrogen fuel cell simply keeps the battery charged.
Our guest is Stephen Chu, former U.S. Secretary of Energy, professor of physics and molecular and cellular physiology at Stanford, and Nobel laureate in physics. Actually, we're doing much better on the battery side of things, aren't we?
Well, it is a pretty exciting time for batteries. Over the last 10 years, I've seen a lot of fresh new ideas. Many of them may not ultimately be commercially successful, but when you see a dozen ideas and some of them look good, there is a real possibility that that one could really make market improvements to batteries. But having said that, I would say that already in the last five years.
I was just going to add, the cost has really gone down.
Thank you. I was about to say that.
Sorry.
That the cost has actually been cut in half over the last 5 years. And virtually every battery manufacturer expects in the next 5 or 6 years that the cost of manufacturing will be cut again in half. Now, there are pretty serious attempts to actually increase the energy density per unit weight, energy density per unit volume, also very important. And I'm hopeful that, you know, in the next bunches of years, we may see some of these different chemistries, both in the anode and the cathode and the electrolytes.
Well, when we talk about energy, and I just want your take on this because you've been so much at the center of energy policy. And in fact, I want to talk to you about things that occurred during your tenure as head of the Department of Energy. But, you know, nuclear energy comes up and it always evokes a great deal of controversy because of nuclear waste and what to do with nuclear waste. And, of course, fracking comes up and we've had many discussions about that on air. And, again, a lot of controversy because of concern about the groundwater and all of that. Give us just your sort of overall pithy sense of how these are going to play in our future and how they should play.
Well, I think when one looks at the energy mix in the United States, first, a very important philosophy is you do not want to put all your eggs in one basket. You want diverse sources of energy, and you want diverse clean sources of energy. Now, regard to nuclear versus all these other things, if you look at every source of energy, one can find flaws in all of them, virtually all of them. People even find flaws in solar rooftops because some people think that makes the roof look ugly. But in any case, one has to say, okay, not any source of energy is perfect, but then you have to trade off. What do you give up? And what, for example, in fracking, you say, well, there have been mistakes in the past, therefore it's no good. We should turn our back on hydraulic fracturing for both oil and gas. And yet we also know that these technologies improve very, very rapidly. The amount of your ability to extract improves to control fugitive emissions, to figure out solutions for the water that comes back in the hydraulic fracking. All of those things are important issues that have to be addressed. But you also have to compare to the way we use coal today. Now, having said that, we need to be able to clean up both coal and natural gas the way we use it today if we're going to go into this mid-century where we have some control of the carbon emissions, not only in the United States but the world. So you look at all these things. Nuclear is a very personal choice from country to country, from quite candidly state to state in the United States. Some citizens feel that they're at ease with nuclear. Others absolutely do not want it. That's a voter choice.
Let's, as I said, look at the time you served in the Department of Energy. President Obama actually gave you credit personally for the Horizon leak and taking care of what BP couldn't take care of necessarily by itself. You got the lion's share of credit for that, and certainly you've had your props. I'm wondering, though, how you respond to, especially since there was this expectation that we'd have all kinds of new jobs that would be proliferating, clean energy jobs. And Daniel Kish, who's president of the Institute for Energy Research, said, and I'm quoting here, "The policies and priorities of Stephen Chu's energy department have benefited our global competitors and intensified the economic pain felt by millions of unemployed Americans."
Well, I'm not sure where he's getting that from. What we were trying to do was develop new technologies. Primarily, the Department of Energy funds research and development into new technologies, hoping the private sector picks it up, driving down the cost of renewable energies, driving down the cost of energy storage, because we think, and not only we, but most countries around the world think that in the coming decades, this is going to be one of the fastest growing sectors, industrial sectors around the world. So if we're investing money to develop these technologies that American manufacturers can make, better solar cells, better batteries, more fuel efficient cars, I'm not sure how one says that this is benefiting our competitors around the world.
You also took a lot of heat at the Summit of the Americas Economic Development when you essentially talked about the inland states disappearing, or at least possibility of that or likelihood of that. I'd like you to get on record about this, because Deputy Chief of Staff Jim Messina said you were clueless politically, and it kind of gave you took you to the woodshed kind of on that. Some thoughts?
Well, yes. First, he might have gotten irritated about it, but I don't recall him talking to me about it, number one. Number two, I think, let's put this in the context. What I believe I said was that if the path we're on, the growth in carbon dioxide continues to rise the way it's been rising, that the climate could change dramatically, and that nation states, low-lying island nation states, are at great risk. I still stand by that. And so to be charged behind my back as being labeled clueless, I still think and most climate science, virtually every climate science agrees, if we're on the trajectory we're on now, the sea rise could be substantial, and it would threaten low-lying nation states.
Actually, what you said made a great deal of sense to many of us, and yet you were criticized, I think, maybe for not being on message or not being political, which amounts to maybe prevaricating or trying to essentially cover up in some way what was so apparent. And it gets right to the part of, you know, here you're a Nobel laureate, an academic, a distinguished academic in Washington, fulfilling a role in some ways which was highly political and politically charged. And the fact of the matter is, you know, I looked at some statistics on cabinet meetings. You were a cabinet member meeting. They were pretty infrequent. And in the first term of the Obama administration, when you served, there were 19 cabinet meetings, and most of them were fairly short.
Well, let's go back to this whole issue about the importance of climate change, the risks we run, things of that nature. You know, I'm very confident. I've talked to the president numerous times about that. We see very much eye to eye on this. To not talk about climate change and not to say, oh, that's politically unwise to even bring it up is something, well, the president has brought it up many times, including inaugural speeches. It's something, the risks are real. The uncertainties are large, but there are considerable risks. And not to bring it up, to say that it's politically wise, I just don't understand it. I think in order to serve the public and as a scientist, you have to say what scientists strongly believe is these risks are, they're real, and we have to take note of them. It's hiding under the rug won't help.
What is it, though, in your perspective, that politicians really don't get about the science of energy or about climate change?
I don't know. Many of them do get it. Many of them do know that there are risks, and no one runs their personal life by saying, well, if there's only a 30% or 50% chance some really bad things will happen, we shouldn't really worry about it. You know, one has health insurance because there you could develop a serious illness that could bankrupt you, something you could not pay for. One has fire insurance because most families, their biggest asset is their home. And you have insurance on this. In the case of climate change, it's not insurance in case there's a loss. It's let's decrease the risks. For example, if you live in the woods, you might want to say, well, we don't want a lot of underbrush in the house because that if should there be a fire, that would increase the probability that your house would catch fire. So you do things to decrease the exposure, the risks. And the climate science has been quite clear. The risk is we have to decrease the greenhouse gas emissions. Otherwise, the longer we wait, the more greenhouse gases there are, the more heat-trapping gases there are, you're just getting to more and more dangerous territory.
When we did that event for the Public Policy Institute, I couldn't help but be impressed with the fact that, in fact, I think the way I phrased it, I was sort of borrowing from former Attorney General John Mitchell, where the developing nations are concerned, the message should be do as we do as opposed to not doing as we did. But that's a message that most of them don't necessarily want to take forward.
Well, it depends on how it's phrased. This was regarding, for example, if you build an infrastructure, we now know how to build buildings that are much more energy efficient than we did 100 or 200 or 300 years ago. And it's in the country's best interest, a developing country, not to use techniques or methods or not to be aware that you can save a lot of money by building energy efficient buildings at higher comfort level with the same amount of money and perhaps even less money that could save tremendously on the cost of operating the building through the heating and the lighting of the building. So you could say that's a do what we say, not what we did, but what we're trying to say is, well, before we knew about climate change, before the price of energy starts to increase, these are the things that are happening now. And it's like 100 years ago or 200 years or whenever, let's see, I'm just thinking the Bell telephone system started roughly the beginning of the 20th century, you don't have to put in landlines today. You can put in cell wireless lines and fiber, but you certainly don't want to do copper lines. So a developing country can leapfrog over what the developed countries did in the past. We've learned terrible lessons in terms of air and water pollution in the first industrial revolution, where the first countries that became industrialized actually did some bad things in terms of the air and water pollution. In the United States, in the 60s and 70s, we finally got hold and said, no, we have to stop this. We're killing our lakes, our rivers, our people by this pollution. And so there again, it's really a question, does the next developing country have to make all the mistakes of the previous developing countries? I don't consider it something wrong if we can try to encourage them. You know, we made mistakes while we were developing. Does everybody have to follow that path and make the same mistakes? Maybe it's a part of the human condition. You're constrained to do that. As parents, we sometimes don't want our children to make the same mistakes that we do. Actually, that's a generational thing. I think they already don't want to do what the parents do. But it may flip back to the grandchildren. But in any case, not wanting to get too philosophical about this.
You are getting philosophical. That's quite all right.
But you know, something as simple as building more efficient buildings and building more efficient appliances, so you don't have to build the old inefficient things that we did because we didn't know better.
We're talking to Stanford physics professor Stephen Chu, former U.S. Secretary of Energy and also Nobel laureate in physics for his work in single molecular physics. I'm wondering where you stand with your commitment to climate change on Keystone XL pipeline. I mean, people like Bill McKibben have said it's a kind of Waterloo in terms of climate change.
Well, that's the president's decision. That's what he gets paid the bucks for. He already has said that he wants to look at that and consider the full environmental ramifications of that. But I would also say I don't want to get too focused on a single issue because that could become a polarizing or a lightning rod effect. Start from the basics. The basics, and this is what physicists do all the time, is that we are running serious risks. The world is running serious risks in the way we're using energy and emitting greenhouse gases. This, as I said before, the uncertainties are quite large, but these are very real risks that could cost society a great deal in the coming decades. So this is a real problem. Recognize the problem. We've got to deal with it. The longer we put off working towards aggressive solutions, the more costly it will be. I think it would be to say that one particular thing is either a yes or no, either we succeed or fail, is perhaps dramatizing it a little too much.
Again, our guest I'm sorry, please finish your thought.
But I would say that I do feel very strongly that there are very serious risks about that. So that, in that sense, there's no disagreement.
Again, our guest is Stephen Chu, and we welcome your involvement in the program. If you have questions or comments, bring them to the fore. Our toll-free number is available to you now. It's 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We'll continue, and we'll hear from you when we return. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Stephen Chu made history as the first Asian-American and the first scientist and Nobel Prize winner to head the U.S. Department of Energy. He served during President Obama's first term and oversaw a $35 billion-plus government investment in clean energy before returning to work as a physics professor at Stanford. And he continues to speak out about the dangers of climate change and is with us to talk this hour. And you are with us as well. In fact, you're invited to join us. You can tweet us @KQED Forum. Is our Twitter handle. You can also join us by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or call us. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. I want to go to calls and emails, many of them coming in. And Let me begin maybe by just getting a kind of summarized statement from you, Stephen Chu, about Solyndra, because when you left, you wrote a letter and you said, this is kind of in the grand scheme of things. I'm paraphrasing, of course, but, you know, things fall and fail all the time, and maybe... people ought to think about the percentage of that. And I'm looking at an email from a listener who says, can you please comment on how the government failed investment in Solyndra changed the Department of Energy's ability to support other startups and companies striving to advance energy technology?
Well, first, let's talk about the original design of the loan program as passed by Congress, as signed by the president. It was designed to first... support renewable research. It was supposed to design to support innovative companies, things of that nature, or companies to help them make a transition, for example, in motor vehicles to more efficient vehicles. The amount of potential funds appropriated for the loan program, which includes companies like Solyndra investments in wind farms and solar farms, and also advanced automobile technologies, the amount that potentially could be appropriated to cover loan losses was about $10 billion. Now, we made a loan, for example, to Ford Motor Company that was a crucial loan to them. It helped them get back on their feet. They're doing very successfully now. It was a $6 billion loan. I am quite confident this is going to be paid back. And indeed, if you look at the loan portfolio over all the loans, in terms of the value of the loans, I would guess when all the dust is settled over the next 10, 20 years that perhaps 90, 95% of those loans will come through. That narrows the charge. People said, well, the government can't play venture capital. That record is substantially better than Wall Street. Forget about venture capital. That's much higher risk because many of the loans, like a large wind farm where the company constructing this wind farm would get a power purchase agreement, a signed contract that each certain distribution utility companies would buy this power at a certain rate. So if the project can be built on time with technology that is reliable, like, for example, GE wind turbines, there is very little risk. So those projects and also the solar projects seem to be in a very good position. And again, that's if you look at the entire loan portfolio program, I think it's going to be very successful. It really did, in the case of the Ford, that was a $6 billion loan, appropriate money that was set aside. That means appropriate money that could not be spent on defense, could not be spent on education, could not be spent on other things. $3 billion set aside. That single loan of $3 billion set aside, I'll give people 2-to-1 odds that that's going to cover any loan loss of all the portfolio of loans. And so, you know, if you look at it through that lens, I would say that it was, for that time, pretty successful. It got, in terms of renewable projects, over a hump where now banks and investors can say, all right, we now know how to build, to install large solar and wind projects. They now think that these projects are, quote, bankable in the sense that you're going to expect a 20, 25-year power purchase agreement. One will get paid back. You can make, a 10 or 20% return, 10% return on your capital over this period of time. This isn't bad. And so you see now a transfer. Berkshire Hathaway is buying in after the projects have been constructed. They're buying into parts of these projects to guarantee a diverse portfolio of investments. So it accomplished, in that sense, it accomplished really what it wanted to do, which is to prove to the private sector that investments like this are bankable. You can make money investing in renewables. Now, let's go to Solyndra specifically. Solyndra was one company among many companies that got caught up in an overinvestment in solar manufacturing. This was primarily led by companies in China where capital was very inexpensive. And, you know, the largest solar company in the world, SunTech, also went bankrupt. It's being held by a parent company in China. China's developed programs to encourage solar investments in their country. They're the biggest installers of renewable in the world in their country. Other companies have gone bankrupt, and so it is, I think, Salinger in part got caught up with that. Right now, though, the solar industry is coming back. It's worked its way through the oversupply problem, and it's reaching a new equilibrium. Solar energy continues to get less expensive. That's great. And so this is, you know, but you have these bumps and wiggles. And then you also have to remember, if you look at any emerging technology, whether it's automobiles or airplanes or computers, electronics, usually at the beginning there's a proliferation of lots of companies and there's a shakeout. That does not mean, for example, in the case of automobiles in the 1920s, there may have been 115 different automobile companies. By the 1960s in the U.S., there were three. Does that mean that the technology, the automobile technology, was a failed technology because so many companies failed? No. This is an inevitable shakeout, a consolidation of lots of starting companies that either consolidate into bigger companies or they fail. You look at electronics, you look at airplane companies, look at all these things, and similar things have occurred. So to say that the technology, in this case solar power, is a failed technology doesn't really capture what really has happened and is happening around the world. The price of solar modules has gone down spectacularly, about a factor of five in the last 6 years. So put in perspective of an automobile, suppose you have a car that you normally spend, say, $30,000 on. A factor of five means you can have the same quality car for $6,000. That is pretty spectacular.
Well, we've got a lot of people who want to talk with you, so let's get to as many as we can. Okay. And let's begin, Bob, with you. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. My question was, I saw a program several years ago that UC Davis was in on the beginning of the hybrid plug-in technology, and they were working on an 80-mile distance hybrid plug-in. I was wondering what the status of that was. And also, I've noticed while I've read on this that the cost of the hybrid plug-ins, they're like charging the manufacturer selling $10,000 premium on cars for that. They haven't really lowered it, even though you said that, you know, the cost has dropped by half. They haven't passed that on, and 5 years going to drop by another half. This kind of reminds me of, you know, the LED large screen 45-inch televisions that were up $5,000, and at some point, all of a sudden, they drop like flies. And I'm wondering what that time frame, what projection you might have for something like that, and also what the status is on long ranges, because I think that that's kind of a critical mass thing when you get to the 80-mile limit. You just be able to plug in your car and go 80 miles. I'm wondering on both those things, if there's some kind of time frame you can give us on what your thinking was on that.
All right, Stephen, sure. Thank you.
Well, once you get to the 80-mile range, that's the range of a Nissan Leaf, roughly 80 miles. And so in a plug-in hybrid, remember, you're also carrying a smaller but still significant load of an internal combustion engine. So I don't really know about this particular plug-in at 80 miles, but most of the plug-ins I know are more of the 40-30-mile range, where 90-95% of your driving occurs in that first 30 or 40 miles. Chevy Volt has got about a 40-mile range. But once you get in a 100-mile range, then you're talking about a little commuter car, a city car, where it seems to be adequate, and then you can dispense with the electric motor. Now, regard to your observation, that is an interesting thing that you said. You know, the manufacturing cost of batteries has plummeted. At the very earliest version, you know, car companies will say, well, we may want to sell at a very, very small profit. As you build up, the early adopters are typically willing to pay more because they feel very strongly about this. And so the manufacturers do this. But then after a while, after it gets momentum, now let's not talk about plug-in hybrids. Let's just call it plain hybrids that began with the Prius. But after a decade, many cars are going to hybrids or mild hybrids. And then there becomes a real competition. The LED TV is an excellent example of this. But actually, you see this now in LED lights, the 60-watt going to 100-watt standard light bulbs, and the flood LEDs have come down to maybe 2 years ago. They're about half the price, I know, because I just went to Home Depot and bought a bunch of 9-watt equivalents of, I think it's 65-watt floods.
Nice plug for Home Depot, Stephen Chu.
Well, I'm sure it's not in all the other places as well. But I'm just saying that I think the 60 – I bought four pack of 60-watt light bulbs. They're now $5 a piece. So that wasn't the case 5 years ago. They were much more expensive. So these things are marching down in a very nice way. It may take 5 years. It may take longer for the car companies. But they are aiming for this sweet spot of less than $30,000, $20,000 to $30,000 for a couple hundred mile range. We will need better and more inexpensive batteries. But that's going to occur. I can't say exactly when, because the first thing car companies like – any company likes to do is they say, let's get the early adopters first. They're willing to pay more money, and then as the longer, a more sizable fraction of the population says, this is a good deal because I get to save money, I get to do something with the environment, I get to do a lot of things. And, oh, by the way, one of my favorite things about plug-in hybrids or electric vehicles is that it gives you the ability to, let's say you take out your smartphone, and you push the single button that tells the car, I'm getting into the car in 2 minutes. Please, if it's a hot summer day, cool it down for me. Or if it's a cold winter morning, please warm it up for me. So when I get into the car, the environment has now been conditioned. It might take a minute or two, but usually the car gets conditioned in an internal combustion engine while you're in the car driving. So you're, you know, for the first couple of minutes, you're either freezing or you're hot and sweaty. You know, with an electric battery, you can do this. So once you get used to things like that, and, you know, and then the car calls you back after 2 minutes and says, I'm ready for you. Where are you? and we could say it in a nicer voice than, let's say, what your spouse might say if they're sitting in the car.
More of a Siri-type voice, I think.
Yes, a nice, pleasant voice saying, the car is ready. Are you coming or should I turn it off? But in any case, these are technologies that can make life much more pleasant, as well as saving a lot on the cost of transportation.
Let me bring some more of our callers in here. And Chris from Oakland, hi, you're on.
Good morning, Mr. Secretary. The entire time you were secretary, my agency, AC Transit, was running a very successful hydrogen fuel cell bus program using hybrid engines, just as you were talking about. We had a standing invitation for you anytime you were in Berkeley to come ride our buses. Secretary LaHood loved them, and we have a number of pictures of him there. And we had a number of your senior staff during the Pacific Rim Energy conference that happened in San Francisco came over and looked at our facilities and our 12 buses. And I want to reissue the invitation. It's running on the 51B right in front of UC Berkeley, and we'll even take one down to Stanford for you.
You've been invited, okay. Stephen Chu.
Okay, thank you. You know, that's a good example. So these hybrid buses, from my knowledge, these have been working. Some of these hybrid buses have very robust fuel cells. They've been working for a decade. All very good. And so I have a question for you. The real issue, though, is it's still a new technology. The cost of the fuel cell to get a robust fuel cell is quite high. And what is your feeling? And the good thing about buses is you can have central fueling stations. And so that takes care of some of the infrastructure. What is your feeling about when they would be competitive without subsidy in terms of the fuel cell.
We had a CARB hearing 2 weeks ago, and the folks from Ballard and the folks who bought the United Technology technology really are saying it's a chicken and egg problem, because they need orders for about 200 buses to be able to get the prices down to below $1 million a bus, which is the target where we're aiming for the whole thing, for bus and everything. But our longest lasting fuel cell has over 15,000 hours on it with no degradation in power. So it's they're pretty rugged, but the costs from our original fuel cells have gone down to a quarter of our original ones. So they're coming down, but it is going to take a while.
Yeah, the early fuel cells had lots of platinum loading. People are trying to either have a substitute material or decrease it, but then you find out if you decrease it too much, then you start to go into the robustness of the fuel cell. And 15,000 hours is great. That's a long time.
Well, let me thank Chris for the call, and the invitation has been extended to the Secretary, and we'll invite another caller. Colin, that's you. Good morning.
Good morning. Secretary Chu, it doesn't seem that the Obama administration has ever seriously considered raising the gasoline tax as a measure to address climate change. Instead, cap-and-trade proposal was brought forward and then dropped out of fear that the Democrats would lose control of Congress. Can you really say that the president has offered any serious measures to address climate change, especially if he's not going to ask the American people to make sacrifices in their current levels of consumption?
Well, I think both Republicans and Democrats, I think the last time the federal gasoline tax was raised was probably in the early 90s. For those of you who don't know, I think it's about 18.3 cents a gallon compared to Europe, which is the equivalent of $3 or $4 a gallon. I think the general feeling in Washington is that if either party advocated a gasoline tax, they would violate the second important golden rule in politics: you're going to get unelected. The American people have to get behind this. And the reaction of the American people to raising a gasoline tax is not going to go over well. I think, though, that a carbon tax, and I would advocate a carbon tax, which you take that and it's an offset for other taxes that we Americans have to pay, so that you're not increasing the tax, you're shifting it. Would be a good way to do this. The amount of tax that you would need is actually a very, very small fraction of the price of gasoline. But it could do a lot of good, especially in the electricity-generating sector. I think it's important that it be revenue neutral, in the sense that Americans see this tax, but they get less of a tax than something else. And it has to be done in a way that does not penalize people who are retired, self-employed people, things of that nature. So it can't just be a payroll tax. But something like that would be go a long way to getting the country going in the right direction.
Well, thank Colin for the call.
Around the world.
It brings me to kind of a general question. We want to get more listeners on here with us, and getting a lot of responses on the website and emails and Facebook comments and questions. But when you look back, especially in the time that you served as Secretary of Energy, what are you most proud of? What do you think was a big success in energy, and what's your biggest disappointment with either the time you served or with the Obama administration per se?
Well, I think when I came in, since I was the first scientist to serve in a cabinet position, excluding Ben Franklin, but that's a long time gap. I also was able to bring in a lot of people scientists, engineers who normally don't think of going into government service, and bring them in really high-quality people. Many of them are there. But even if you bring them in for 2, 3, 4 years, it really helps rejuvenate the place so that whatever money you do have, you can invest it more wisely in those research and development projects that could really make a difference that the private sector can pick up. So the thing I'm most proud of are bringing these people, helping start ARPA-E, the Advanced Research Project for Energy, that was started in the Recovery Act, but now is base budgeted. The quality of people that came into that program was truly outstanding, and
you should mention that was modeled on the DARPA program.
Yes, it was. It was came an outgrowth of a committee called Rising Above the Gathering Storm that Norm Augustine had chaired. It's a 20-person committee. I happened to be on that committee, and just by coincidence, when it came time for this, it's a National Academy of Science and Engineering report. They were trying to sell it to Congress to authorize it, and I was sent to the House Committee on Science to try to convince them that it would be a good thing. I also tried to convince the previous secretary it would be a good thing, but other career people in the department did not. They were afraid that it would crowd out basic research. I felt differently. I think they're not in competition. ARPA-E is more short term applied. Just nudge it over, but to really invest in more daring things that could be game changers. I'm very proud of that. Arun Majumdar, the first director, was spectacular. If you look at the program managers in that program over the last 4 years, they've been truly spectacular.
Well, there's been a lot of accomplished by that. But when you look back, or when you even look now, the Obama administration, what's the big disappointment, if any? And energy.
Well, still, I think there's still some confusion in the American public that we are running great risks unless we begin to really think hard about mitigating our carbon emissions, decreasing our carbon emissions. That's something that I would have hoped we were further along on, but one can't give up trying. The technologies are improving. It's a matter of time as to when renewable energies, including distribution and storage, will be competitive on a non-subsidized basis with any form of energy, whether in wind it could be 5 years from today, it could be 10 years today, but it's of that time scale.
Well, it brings in actually a comment from a listener. Mike on Facebook writes, what will it take in the political arena to get a comprehensive long-term national energy policy? And he says, I don't even want to be greedy and ask about an emphasis on renewables, though it seems obvious that the 21st century will require as much. I'd settle for any coherent long-term energy policy at all.
So would I. But the way things have historically been done in the United States is that the states take leadership, as you well know. And California has been a leader since the middle 1970s. New York, Massachusetts, other states. Most of the population in the United States live in states which have renewable portfolio standards. So traditionally the federal government has not led in things like this. It's the states that do the leading, and then eventually everybody says, hey, this is the right thing to do. Appliance standards were state-led, again, California. And then finally the federal government says, yes, this is a way to help consumers save money.
Since you're talking about leadership from California, I want to get you on record as to your thoughts about the proposed funding rules, the proposed fracking rules in California. Where do you stand?
Well, I actually think that one has to look very carefully at this. I believe that it is possible to have rules and possible to get industry to extract these sources safely. I haven't really looked at the detailed proposed legislation, but most of the things that have happened because one wasn't following best practices in terms of drilling, things of that nature. And again, the technology improves quite rapidly in your ability to control fugitive emissions, to find out what, you know, what's happening, to not to overfrack, again, for the water issues. All these things are very important, but it's not either you don't do fracking or you do it and you you have to say these are the consequences. I think you, in this instance, you can greatly improve the environmental safety of this fracking and be able to use this natural gas as a transition fuel to where renewables become a major part of what we will be using.
So seconds left, you remain guardedly optimistic.
Well, as the little group that you were met with said, if you don't, and I feel this way, if I'm not optimistic and say, well, what's the use? It's all over. You just can't do that. This is really high stakes. This is something that affects everyone in the world and the future generations. So you better be optimistic because we better succeed.
On that note.
There's no choice.
Stephen Chu, thank you so much for being with us on Forum.
All right.
Stephen Chu, again, is Nobel laureate in physics, former U.S. Secretary of Energy, and professor of physics and molecular and cellular physiology at Stanford. And we are here with you every Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Jim Bennett. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. And for all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.